Proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, a lot in the news today. A number of things that, yeah, I mean, there's the big stuff, and then there's the stuff that's behind the big stuff. And this is the stuff that I find, frankly, most interesting. I mean, you get the screaming headlines at the top of the hour. I mean, Air America News does a great job of, you know, just identifying the news, and sometimes the news behind the news. But you know, we all get the news throughout. But what's really behind? For example, George W. Bush yesterday, talking about his definition of success in Iraq. You've heard me go on and on at some length over the years about the difference between liberals and conservatives, and how it's grounded in a fundamental worldview, a fundamental difference of worldview. That the liberals that founded this country believed that the purpose of government, because people are essentially good, the purpose of government is to help people reach their fullest potential. That is to backstop people. And so Ben Franklin started the first public library. Thomas Jefferson first started the first free public university, the University of Virginia. The founders really got it. As Alexis de Tocqueville said in 1836 in his book Democracy on America, and I'm wildly paraphrasing here, but essentially, in order to have democracy, you have to have the institutions of civil society. And that's what we created in this country, were the institutions of civil society. We had just had a terrible war, the Revolutionary War in 1776. A third of Americans were in favor of that war when it started, and two-thirds of Americans were opposed to it. About a third of Americans left this country during that time, and huge numbers of people died. There, as Jimmy Carter writes in his novel about the Revolutionary War, which is based on fact, there were very few families in this country. Well, not very few, but many. Let me rephrase it. Many families in this country were torn apart. It was not unlike the Civil War, where you literally had one brother who thought that we should separate from England, and another who thought we didn't, and they ended up fighting on different sides, or son against father, or vice versa, that kind of thing. But when the war was over, we pulled together and said, let's create the civil institutions of governance in this country. Now, here's George W. Bush yesterday speaking about his definition of success in Iraq. And I want you to listen to this very carefully, because it reveals the conservative worldview that we've been seeing writ large now for 26 years in this country, since Reagan came into office. And I would say, frankly, in this context, I would put Bill Clinton into the liberal camp. So, you know, I disagree with him on trade and a few other things, But with the exception of Clinton, for the 26 years that we've had this conservative worldview ruling this country, just listen carefully to George W. Bush here.
Slowly but surely, the truth will be known. Either we'll succeed or we won't succeed. And the definition of success, as I described, is, you know, sectarian violence down. If success is not no violence. There are parts of our own country that, you know, have got, you know, a certain level of violence to it. But success is a level of violence where the people feel comfortable about living their daily lives. And that's what we're trying to achieve.
Now, that's the real key, is that conservatives believe that the only purpose of government is to restrain people. That the and you've heard many of them on this program over the last, what, we're in our fifth year here in the noon to three Eastern time day part. You have heard many, many, many conservatives, probably hundreds of conservatives on this program, repeatedly say government's primary purpose, or in many cases only purpose, should be to have to be the police and the army. Conservatives believing that the humans are essentially evil, and therefore the only purpose of government is to restrain that evil so it doesn't emerge and create chaos, as Thomas Hobbes wrote about in Leviathan back in the 1630s when he first laid out the conservative worldview. and then quoted by Sir Edmund Burke in the 1790s, and then quoted by Russell Kirk in 1953, and then quoted by William F. Buckley, and then and right up to George W. Bush right here, right now, essentially saying it's not about building civil institutions. And this is the difference between the liberal Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman after World War II. What was the first thing they did when they went into Europe? They gave the Europeans, particularly Germany, our enemy, they gave the German government the money to jumpstart their own industries to rebuild the infrastructure of civil society. That was the higher priority than running around with police saying, we're gonna stomp things down, whereas what did Bush do after we invaded Iraq? Very little of that. To the extent, in fact, I would say virtually none of that in terms of saying to the Iraqis, who already knew how to build a country. And the Iraqis knew perfectly well how to build a country. They had done it. How do you think Iraq got to be Iraq? So here, the Iraqis, they built palaces, they built water treatment plants, they built generating plants, they had telephone systems, they had, anything that we have here, they have in terms of, you know, the competence of technology. They had the internet, they had television, they had radio. It was all there. And it wasn't all there because some American corporation brought it there. It was because they had an indigenous, a local, they had an Iraqi, a variety of Iraqi industries. They made their own clothes, they made their own shoes, they made their own, you know, you name it. And if after Bush's successful war, which ended 4 years ago this week, his successful illegal war, let us add, if after that war, Bush had gone in and said, okay, we've knocked down Saddam Hussein. Now we realize that what makes a society work is its civil institutions. And so we're going to help you guys rebuild your schools immediately. We're going to put the hospitals back together. We're going to get the water running. We're going to get the electricity on. We're going to help rebuild the police force so that the traffic will flow. Again, that's not police in its protective sense. That's police in its helping the civil institutions of society function. We're going to help build mass transit. We're going to help you rebuild your industries. But instead, the neocons took over. I mean, this was their goal from the very beginning. They had looked at World War II, and they'd seen what Harry Truman and what, you know, Franklin Roosevelt, and of course Truman, you know, Roosevelt died before the war finally ended. And so there was Harry Truman and George Marshall, and John Maynard Keynes, the economist, they went into Europe and they said, you know, why don't you guys rebuild your countries with and rewrite your constitutions with strong protections for labor like we did with the Wagner Act in 1935? Why don't you have a national health care system like Harry Truman proposed in the United States in 1947? The Republicans wouldn't even hold a vote on. Why don't you rebuild the infrastructure of civil society? We'll provide you with the money, part of it grants, part of it loans. We'll help you build your country. This was the genesis of the World Bank, for that matter, was helping fund, you know, loan some money to European countries so that they could get back on their feet. We're going to help you do this with this liberal worldview. And sure enough, it worked. But the neocons came into Iraq, and Paul Bremer, you know, well, first you had a general who actually understood how this worked. And he said, well, let's hold elections. And Bremer, you know, he was gone in a month. And Bremer comes in and says, George W. Bush's old roommate at Andover Prep School, where Bush's singular distinction was that he was a cheerleader. In fact, he was the head of the cheerleading squad, the only intramural activity he participated in. He felt right at home, you know, with that bullhorn on 9/11. That was his moment in the sun. So Paul Bremer, Bush's old buddy, comes in and he's part of this neocon cabal that believes that it was just a fluke that Europe did so well as a consequence of the Marshall Plan. It was just a fluke. It was because the Germans and the Japanese are industrious people. That's it. And so we're going to do it differently. We're going to create a libertarian, conservative, neoconservative paradise in Iraq. And so they changed the constitution of Iraq. They changed the rules so the labor unions were outlawed, so that any multinational corporation could come in and do anything they want. So any government support for any industries was stripped out, so that government that the traditional commons, the healthcare system was going to be privatized, the Social Security system was going to be taken down, their equivalent of a food stamp program was being phased out. All of these things, you know, public utilities would be sold off to private corporations, public water systems would be sold off to private corporations, Bechtel and Halliburton would come in and jumpstart all this stuff, and they didn't even have to have local labor. They didn't even have to have Iraqi labor. They could bring in labor from Bangladesh and Sri Lanka, the cheapest labor they could find, they could bring it in, and they thought that this would create a paradise. They were so prepared for this, they were so certain of this, there wasn't even a plan B. And what did it do? It did what... It created the disaster we have. There has never been, in the history of the world, a successful country based on neoconservative or libertarian principles. They thought they could do it in Iraq. They blew it. And now they're not talking about it anymore. They were bragging before they went into Iraq about what their plans were. They're not talking about it anymore. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
We're dreaming again. We're dreaming about an America where American democracy and this constitutionally limited democratic republic is back. It's made a return. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Bush defining success in Iraq. This is really worth noting.
A level of violence where the people feel comfortable about living their daily lives. And that's what we're trying to achieve.
They're trying to achieve a diminished level of violence where people... See, in Bush's worldview... If there are just enough cops on the street, everything else will take care of itself because this mythical, magical thing called the free market and multinational corporations who are part of it will take care of all people's needs. This is a true conservative point of view. And it doesn't work. But I guess at least he's consistent with his point of view. Similarly, conservatives are not limited to the United States, by the way. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, visited a couple of days ago with his school teacher, the woman who was the teacher, his school teacher when he was like a little kid. This woman wore thick gloves along with a headscarf and a long black coat. He did not make any skin-to-skin contact with her. But he did lift up her hand and kiss the back of her glove. This was supposed to be a gesture of public humility before Iranian teachers, who are, by the way, out there protesting and demonstrating against their low salaries. And so this was Ahmadinejad trying to say, oh, you know, I really respect teachers. Well, what's happened is the conservative clerics in his country have gone after him. The ultra-conservative Hezbollah newspaper, no relationship to the terrorist group in Lebanon, criticized him on its front page. This front page editorial, he said, the Muslim Iranian people have no recollection of such acts contrary to Sharia law during Islamic rule since the 1979 revolution. This type of indecency progressively has grave consequences like violating religious and sacred values. See, conservatives believe that the definition of morality has to do with ultimately... The leaking out of the evil that is inherent in everyone. So if Ahmadinejad is kissing her gloved hand, the next thing he'll do is he'll peel back that glove and kiss her arm, and the next thing he'll do is he'll start moving his kisses up the arm, and pretty soon, uh-oh! Just like Richard Gere in India kissing the Indian actress. He thought it was no big deal. He thought it was an American Idol kind of, the dance program, Dancing with the Stars, thank you. That, you know, he thought it was a Dancing with the Stars kind of thing. little did he know, right? Because the conservatives think, oh, you know, you got to keep that evil under control, because if it gets out, all hell is going to break loose, literally. Whereas the liberal worldview is, let's focus on backstopping the world. The liberal worldview articulated by, you know, one of history's first most outspoken liberals, Jesus, saying, you know, if you have hungry among you, if you have poor among you, if you have homeless among you, if you have naked among you, if you have thirsty among you, if you have people in prison among you and you're not visiting them, you cannot call yourselves moral people. Similarly, in Iran, the Culture Committee of the Iranian Parliament approved on Monday a bill sentencing to death producers of pornography. Amateur porn films prosperous market in Iran. It's an underground market, but it's doing quite well. It's been tolerated. Well, it's not going to be tolerated anymore. They're going to put people to death for this. Pretty amazing. And then sometimes there's just the, you know, the kind of cool stuff. Spring arrived at Joe's Pond at exactly 4:45 p.m. on Tuesday. That's when a 65-pound cinder block fell through the ice. This is in Montpelier, Vermont, where I used to live. My town here for five years before I, and in Vermont 10 years before we moved out here 2 years ago to Portland, Oregon. Joe's Pond, just north of where I used to live. And before that, we used to live in New Hampshire on Stinson Lake. I won. Actually, my birthday is May 7th, and I won the bet at Mike and Ray's little country store there on Stinson Lake, where they you know, you put a buck in the pot and pick a date. And everybody did. There's a jar on the counter, and I bet my birthday on the day that the ice would go off the lake. And in fact, we had a cat, Barley, who died of old age at like 19. She was just a wonderful cat. And we were building houses on both sides of the lake. This is when we were creating this community for abused kids. And it was a 2,000-acre lake, 3.5 miles around the lake. And Barley walked across the lake in the dead of winter because, you know, when we took her kittens away from her, when we thought there was time to wean them and gave them to the kids in one of the other houses, she would walk across the lake at night to nurse her kittens. We didn't realize she was doing it for a couple of weeks. It was incredible. I mean, just human instinct. But just an amazing thing. So anyhow, spring has arrived at Joe's Pond, and stranger things happening in Minnesota. And I'll share that with you, our little crazy alert, and take your calls right after this. I also want to get in some information about Dick Durbin, in defense of Dick Durbin, as it were. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com. Click live chat up at the top of the page. You want to drop into our live chat room, 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Bring democracy back to America. 34 minutes past the hour. And time to take a real brief look before we get to your calls at a new report out of Media Matters of what's going on. Actually, this came off of Think Progress. Think Progress. What's going on with our favorite crazy person? Could it be? A new study by Indiana University media researchers finds that Fox News host Bill O'Reilly calls a person or a group a derogatory name once every 6.8 seconds on average, nearly nine times every minute during the editorials that open his program every night.
Orlando, Florida, Mike, go.
Hey, Bill, I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
I like to listen to you during the day. I think Keith Olbermann showed it.
There you go. Mike is, he's a gone guy. You know, we have your phone numbers, by the way. So if you're listening, Mike, we have your phone number. and we're going to turn it over to Fox Security, and you'll be getting a little visitor.
Maybe Mike is coming up with it.
No, maybe Mike's going to get in big trouble, because we're not going to play around. When you call us, ladies and gentlemen, just so you know, we do have your phone number. Yeah.
Now, to me, they're not fighting it hard enough. See, if I'm president, I got probably another 56,000 with orders to shoot on sight anybody violating curfews. Shoot them on sight. That's me. President O'Reilly, curfew in Ramadi, 7 o'clock at night. You're on the street, you're dead.
I don't give them any protection. I don't feel sorry for them. In fact, I probably would have ordered their execution if I had the power.
Yeah. Oh, it just keeps on. The hits just keep on coming.
I see the right-wing smear tactics have begun against Cindy Sheehan. Well, I don't know where you're seeing that. Not here.
Yeah. And, of course, our all-time favorites.
So, all those clowns over at the Liberal Radio Network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
Mm-hmm, yes. All right, we're ready to go. So, our crazy alert for the day. What can you say? What can you say? By the way, the House had a veto-proof, I believe, I'm pretty sure of this, the House had a veto-proof majority when they sent this Iraq funding bill off to Bush. When they voted on it yesterday, they did not. It fell short by a vote of 222 to 203. Seven Democrats broke rank. Seven Democrats who had voted for the bill decided to also vote, or oppositely vote, to uphold Bush's veto. John Barrow of Georgia, Dan Boren of Oklahoma, Lincoln Davis of Tennessee, Jim Marshall of Georgia, Jim Matheson of Utah, Michael McNulty of New York, and Gene Taylor of Mississippi. My guess is that these are Democrats who are facing strong conservative Democratic opposition or strong Republican opposition in their districts, and they're trying to have it both ways. They want to be able to say in the campaign commercials in the 08 election, because every single person in the House of Representatives is up for re-election every 2 years, unlike the Senate, where it's every 6 years. So all of these guys in the House are up for re-election. And what they know is that what's going to come down the road is attack ads attacking them for, you know, being white flag surrender monkeys. And so they're saying that by voting to uphold Bush's veto, they will, this is my take on their political calculus, that they will be able to say, oh, well, you know, we did support the president. On the other hand, so they can have it both ways. I think it's frankly a cowardly act, but I also understand the political realities and frankly, I'd rather see a Democrat survive in the House than not. On the other hand, too, although I'd like to see all of them become far more progressive, but that's our work. That's not their work. We need to be convincing them. Secondly, two Republicans broke rank and voted to override Bush's veto, Wayne Gilchrist and Walter Jones. Wayne Gilchrist of Maryland and Walter Jones of North Carolina. And so those are two Republicans that need to be, we need to call out to them and say, good on you. You know, that's the kind of thing that we want. Right. You know, congratulations. Yeah. So, Republicans Wayne Gilchrist and Walter Jones, congratulations. Good on you for voting to override the veto of George W. Bush. And finally, and I want to get into this gas boycott thing and also Dick Durbin. This, I just tossed this out and then we can just talk about it. This Dick Durbin on the floor of the Senate, yesterday, I believe this was, might have been the day before.
A few hundred feet away from here, in a closed room, carefully guarded, the Intelligence Committee was meeting on a daily basis for top secret briefings about the information we were receiving, and the information we had in the Intelligence Committee was not the same information being given to the American people. I couldn't believe it. Members of this administration were in active, heated debate over whether aluminum tubes really meant that the Iraqis were developing nuclear weapons. Some within the administration saying, of course not. It's not the same kind of aluminum tube.
Now, keep in mind, what he's pointing out here is that what he and other senators in the Intelligence Committee were hearing wasn't that the administration was lying, but that the administration was debating. Okay, that there was a debate going on.
At the same time that members of the administration were telling the American people to be fearful of mushroom-shaped clouds.
Now, there's the lie. So in private, they're saying there's a debate. Out in public, they're saying there's no debate.
I was angry about it. Frankly, I couldn't do much about it. Because you see, in the Intelligence Committee, we're sworn to secrecy.
And that's a very real thing. If any of them had violated that oath, Well, first of all, the Intelligence Committee would never get another secret briefing. They'd never get the truth again, which would be a disaster, number one. Number two, if Dick Durbin had violated that oath, he probably could have been impeached. The entire right-wing machine would have been all over him, and he could have been prosecuted. He could have gone to prison.
We can't walk outside the door and say the statement made yesterday by the White House is in direct contradiction to classified information that's being given to this Congress. We can't do that. We couldn't make those statements. And so in my frustration, I sat here on the floor of the Senate and listened to this heated debate about invading Iraq, thinking the American people are being misled. They're not being told the truth.
And so therefore he did what he could, which is vote no on the war.
And that's why I joined 22 of my colleagues in voting no. I didn't feel at the time that the American people knew the real facts. So what happened? We invaded, turned loose hundreds, if not thousands, of people scouring Iraq for these weapons of mass destruction. Never found one of them. Look for nuclear weapons. No evidence whatsoever.
Now, this is not a George Tenet mea culpa. There's a huge difference between Dick Durbin and George Tenet. George Tenet went along, said, sure, I'll help you make the case, kept his mouth shut for years. Dick Durbin went out and voted no. He said no. So what Dick Durbin did in the Senate would be the equivalent of if Tenet had said to George W. Bush, no, you shouldn't do this. I'm not going to help you make a case for this. And I know that Dick Durbin is getting a lot of heat for this, and frankly, on both sides. The GOP now they're running ads. Dick Durbin doesn't even have an opponent yet in the election coming up. But this from the Daily Herald, which I'm assuming is an Illinois newspaper, Dick Durbin, the senior senator from Illinois, the National Republican Senatorial Committee has put an ad online ripping Democratic Senator Dick Durbin in the Iraq War, even though it hasn't found someone to run against him next year. The ad posted on YouTube takes Durbin to task for a recent speech he gave. You just heard it. The ad goes on to quote three of Durbin's fellow Democratic senators who also sat on the intelligence panel saying before the war that then-Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein was building weapons of mass destruction and dangerous. Now, again, Durbin wasn't addressing the issue of whether or not there were weapons of mass destruction. He was addressing the issue of aluminum tubes and whether they could be used for nuclear reactors or nuclear bombs, not the anthrax, not the CS gas, not all that other stuff. Then the ad, the Republican ad, says, is Dick Durbin lying to us now? Let us not participate in this right-wing smear of Dick Durbin. Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Ralph, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, can I just make a short excerpt there with regard to Dick Durbin?
Mm-hmm.
When I was in Southeast Asia, I was with a unit, Task Force Alpha, Igloo White, Nakhon Phnom, Thailand, that basically had classifications of the yin-yang, and we were analyzing a whole bunch of things. When I got to Saigon, I guess I would say I had a Dick Durbin moment. Well, I had a Dick Durbin career. Fundamentally, we knew what was going on. It was all classified. The press was being briefed, and it was totally different from what we knew was happening. The press briefings, as you know, were referred to as the 5 o'clock follies.
Right.
That's a polite word for the 5 o'clock lying through your teeth.
Yep.
Day after day after day, the Nixon administration, I'm sure Johnson did it before, and Bush is doing it now, lies to the American people through the press, and they classify what's really going on.
Yep.
Now, can I have a little bit more time for another comment?
Well, we have 45 seconds before the music starts.
Very briefly, neocons would not survive in battle. Soldiers live as a unit, as a community. Lay down your life for your brother. You are your brother's keeper. Neocons are all about themselves. They're the people that would have a grenade come through their door without a pin in it. They live for themselves. They don't live for their men. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah. So your point, Ralph, that the conservative philosophy is being played out on both ends. It's the ends justifies the means here?
Yes, at the high level. At the high level, we're for ourselves. Yeah. At the low level, in order to survive, you have to be for everybody in your unit.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, well said. Well said. And Dick Durbin now coming out and saying this, which is great, and he voted no, which is great. And so I just, you know, I realize some people will disagree with me on this, and I honor that. But I think that we have to be pretty straightforward about this. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
6 3 0 3 22 70. Magic of democracy keeps rolling along. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Jake in Arcata, California, you're on the air. Hey, Jake.
Hey, Tom, how's it going? You know, this week the media celebrated the four-year anniversary of Bush's trip to the aircraft carrier with his mission accomplished speech, saying that major combat operations were over in Iraq. But now when you have Bush, he's escalated the war with his so-called surge, and his idea of success is that the level of violence will be reduced. Well, the level of sectarian violence in Iraq has only gone up. The number of our soldiers being killed has risen. This is not a success. It's a failure. And still, Bush vetoes the money for the troops. The Democrats provide money for the troops, and all they do is put in a non-binding aspect in the bill saying bring the troops home by September 2008, and Bush doesn't want money for the troops. Bush wants no opposition at all, regardless of what the American public wants. And the Democrats, they just need to stay with it. Unfortunately, according to the Washington Post this morning, there's a report that Democratic leaders are going to back down and take out the timelines on this. But what they should do is they should stick to their guns, Tom.
Because I agree. Americans absolutely. People should be calling their member of the House or Senate, their member of the House and both of their senators. The telephone number in Washington, D.C. is 202-225-3121. And seriously, emails, 90% of the emails that get to Capitol Hill are ignored, particularly if you're out of districts. A lot of members of Congress won't even take them if you're out of the district. And if you send them a letter, it can take as much as a month and a half to get through all the anthrax detectors. So call them, 202-225-3121, and say, would you please hold another vote on the exact same legislation and send the exact same legislation to George W. Bush, and every time he vetoes it, send it back to him. Over and over and over again. It's time for the Democrats to stand up and say, hey, this is the right strategy. And I'm one of those people who thought that this, and continue to think, that this bill was way too generous to Bush. I thought that they should have said, fine, here's 6 months worth of money in order to get the troops out right now and make that transition to all of the other people in the region. But this is what we have. This is what the Democrats have. They should at least have the spine to stand by it. And so I encourage you to call your member of Congress. Yeah, this is the switchboard. If you're not sure who represents you in the House of Representatives, give them your zip code. They'll tell you. And whatever state you're in, tell them what the state, and they'll tell you who your two senators are. That's three phone calls to 202-225-3121. And, you know, let them know your thoughts. I mean, if you disagree with them, let them know that, too. This is a representative democracy. All of us should be, you know, laying out our thoughts to our representatives so that they can actually represent us. Ransom, driving in Ohio. Hey, Ransom, what's up?
Hi. I'm a former scientist and teacher, and now I'm driving a truck to support my family. But the more I listen to you and your scholarly show, I have an idea that I wish I had time to do myself. It'd be nice if someone could write a simple chronology of the neocon revolution starting in 1980, about everything they've done wrong, the scandals, the crooks, and the impact that it's had on America. Because when you think, there's a lot of books on the out now which deal with specific issues, and they go in depth, but it's all interconnected, how things in Iraq can even be connected to Iran-Contra back in the 80s. And it'd be nice for the majority of people, not too in-depth, but enough to see what the neocon experiment and how America got burnt with it. could be.
No, it's a great suggestion. It's a great suggestion, Ransom, and I hope somebody will. I did a good chunk of that on the economic side of my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What You Can Do About It. It really, goes from 1980 to now. But you're right. The bigger picture hasn't been written to the best of my knowledge, and somebody should. Ian in San Francisco. Hey, Ian.
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Listen, I wanted to ask the question, how is it that Durbin can now talk about what he heard, but he couldn't talk about it then?
I don't know.
The only thing I can think of is that the subject has come out. We now know the tubes weren't really for nuclear weapons and all that kind of nonsense. But it seems like we need...
My guess would be that a lot of those briefings have been declassified at this point. Yeah.
Well, that may be. I think it seems to me we need a change in the law then, and that is that if contrary evidence is given to the Intelligence Committee than is being given to the American public and the rest of the Congress, that would tend to put us into a position of going to war, then that information is releasable to the public.
You know, Ian, what we're trying to do by kludging together laws here is prevent ourselves from being screwed again by a president who's willing to lie to us. And frankly, they're few and far between. And we do need some sort of defense against that, yes. And people like Russ Feingold, who stood up, and voted against the Patriot Act, for example, spoke out against that. You know, there's some good people of good conscience in the Senate, and the 22 Democrats who voted against the authorization to go to war in Iraq. And it wasn't even an authorization to go to war in Iraq. It was an authorization to use force to threaten Saddam Hussein to disarm. And the majority of Democrats in the House, did the right thing. But I get your point, and I just don't know how to do it. I think really what we need are people who are statesmen rather than political hacks like Bush. Don in Missoula. Hey, Don, just a little less than a minute here before we got to wrap up this hour.
Okay, well, here's my situation. I heard about a proposal on the Iraq Oil Ministry's desk delivered February of 07. It was designed by what I heard as an American company out of Virginia, and the purpose of the proposal is to deliver 80% of Iraqi's oil to private American companies.
Right. 83% actually. Iraq gets to keep 17% of the revenue. These are called production sharing agreements. It's the kind of deal that's typically done with a third world country that doesn't have the money to do their own drilling. And it is across the Middle East, all of these countries have rejected production sharing agreements over the years. Most of them started out that way. I mean, Saudi Arabia started out that way 50 years ago. But then they said, hey, we'll go into a partnership with you guys, thus Aramco. And then, a decade or two decades ago, they just kicked us out and said, this is our oil. And that's pretty much how everybody else is. And the cons want to say, no, you can bring in ExxonMobil, no problem. Up next, Michael Cannon with the Cato Institute. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Well, this is interesting. The administration, welcome back to the program, by the way. The administration says this, thinkprogress.org. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice met Syria's foreign minister Thursday in the first high-level talks between the two countries in years. House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Tom Lantos, Democrat from California, who earlier said Vice President Cheney would rather see Speaker Pelosi in the kitchen than conducting diplomacy, released a statement on this meeting. He says, as a lifelong internationalist, Secretary Rice knows better than most the great value of face-to-face discussion, even those with whom we strongly disagree. Now the secretary will meet with her Syrian counterpart. This is a marked improvement in the administration's ostrich policy approach and a tacit admission of how wrong it was last month in criticizing the Speaker of the House and congressional colleagues, including myself, for going to Damascus. Tom Lantos was one of the members of Congresswoman Pelosi's, Speaker Pelosi's, what would you call it, delegation that visited Syria on their way back from the Middle East. It is infinitely better to confront in a firm but civilized way those with whom we disagree than simply to give them the silent treatment. Amen, Tom Lantos. But here's where it gets really interesting. The Washington, we were talking just before the break about the future of this Iraq resolution, this Iraq funding resolution. And the position that I've been taking, and I've been taking it all along, and I can't claim that it was originally my idea. It was actually, I stole it from John Edwards. But I think it's the best thing to do. I mean, you know, if I was, you know, writing all the rules, if I was a member of the House or Senate, then I would be putting forth a piece of legislation that says, no, here's that. Well, frankly, what I would do is I would say, okay, Mr. Bush, you have vetoed this piece of legislation. You have enough money to continue your little war or whatever you want to call it, your occupation, until the end of August. That money is in the budget all right now. You can spend, you know, plus the Pentagon's lost $2 trillion somewhere along the way. Maybe you can find some of it. Use the next 4 months very wisely and very carefully to get our troops out of there safely. And let the Iraqis rebuild Iraq. And let's start talking about the rest of the world. Let's bring in the United Nations. Let's talk with the rest of the world about a new Marshall Plan for the Middle East, for Iraq, to try to rebuild the civil society, the civil structures. Now, I get it that Bush, being a conservative, instead has this worldview that the only thing that really government should be doing is reducing the level of violence by police action.
But success is a level of violence where the people feel comfortable about living their daily lives. And that's what we're trying to achieve.
But in fact, what causes people to feel comfortable about living their daily lives is not just the lack of violence. It's that they have a job that they can go to, that they can go to university, they can go to school, they can go to a trade school, they can create a future for themselves and for their children can go to school, that their civil institutions, their institutions of civil society function. Those are the things that cause the reduction in violence, not the other way around. You know, in the United States, we had back in the 1840s, I think it was 1844, maybe it was 46 or 48, was the year of the Great Potato Famine in Ireland. And, you know, that deserves a whole other rant in and of itself, because during the potato famine, when that fungus started spreading across Ireland and killing off the potatoes, Ireland exported, during the 2 years of the potato famine, when several million people died in Ireland, as I recall. It's been a few decades since I read this history, but I think I'm pretty close here. I know this one fact. During the period of time that the potato famine was going on and people were literally starving to death, Ireland exported enough wheat to England to feed everybody in Ireland and more. But it was illegal for them to eat that wheat, because that wheat was being grown on privatized property that was owned by the British. And the Irish were simply the workers in the agricultural factory, I guess you could call it, the farms. It was not all that different, frankly, from the way that they're doing it in Iraq right now, where all the industries are being bought up by multinational corporations who are going to run them, and they're not even bothering to hire Iraqis. At least the British were hiring the Irish. But in any case, all these Irish came to the United States in the 1840s. Landed on the East Coast, heavily concentrating in Philadelphia and Boston, particularly Boston. And because many of them did not have skills, they were essentially refugees. And because the labor market in the United States in those areas was not large enough to absorb all these people, there was a crime problem. Well, as the economy grew, and we went through the Civil War and after the Civil War, and the Industrial Revolution started, there were jobs for those people to go to. And so but now keep in mind, in the 1840s, the Irish crime problem, there were all these debates and discussions, serious discussions in like scientific publications about whether the Irish had a gene that predisposed them to crime, because there was all that crime. 20 years later, 30 years later, you've got the next generation of kids, of these Irish Catholic kids. And now there's enough jobs for them. There's no longer crime. Nobody's talking about the Irish crime problem in the 1870s, 1880s. Now it's the Italian immigrants who are coming in. And, oh, there's this Italian crime. It must be genetic. And again, it was, you know, another wave of immigration driving down the cost of labor, increasing poverty. And what happens with increased poverty when you don't have the social services, you don't have the social systems, they didn't have welfare, they didn't have social security, they didn't have Medicare, they didn't have the institutions of civil society that the rest of the industrialized world has and that we have in some small measure. And as a consequence, people literally had to turn to crime in order to feed their families to survive. So the Bushies have the process wrong. They think that if you can stop the violence, if they could have in the 1840s simply put enough cops on the street to keep the Irish from picking pockets and stealing bread, that everything would be fine. If in the 1880s, 1890s, they could only have put enough cops on the streets to stop the Italians from, you know, and on it goes, right? If we could only put a, today, the consequence of 200-300 years of institutionalized racism, slavery, and discrimination. Oh, if you could only put enough cops on the streets in the African-American communities in the United States, or increasingly in the Latino districts in the United States. Nonsense. Put jobs into those communities. Put the infrastructure of civil society into those communities. And if you don't have private employers, if you don't have private corporations who are willing to go into those communities or who are able to go into those communities and say, okay, here we are, we're looking to hire you, do what Franklin Roosevelt did. Let the government be the employer of last resort to jumpstart it. Because once the government comes in as the employer of last resort and puts people to work, you go into some of these blighted neighborhoods and say, okay, we're going to give everybody a decent paying job. The job is going to be fixing up the neighborhood. Let's rebuild some of these buildings. Let's rebuild some of the streets. Let's rebuild the bridges. We're going to put everybody to work here. We have some artists among you. You can do the murals. We have writers. You can write the history of what's going on. We have people who can work well with their hands. You can work on the streets. You do that, and what you're going to do is put money in those people's pockets. They're going to have that money to spend. What are they going to do with that money? They're going to spend it in their local community. Now you have all kinds of entrepreneurs coming in saying, hey, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, they're going to open shop. And pretty soon you have a thriving community. It all starts with the institutions of civil society. It doesn't start with having enough cops. Or in the case of Iraq, having enough army. Now, that said, the Washington Post has just come out this morning and said that Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi have already played the surrender monkey routine with regard to George W. Bush, that they've already decided to strip out of the bill that they're going to resubmit to the White House language that would require timelines for withdrawal. Only problem, you can find this over at talkingpointsmemo.com, only problem, the blog, the horse's mouth blog, you contact Pelosi and Reid's office and they say, no, that's not what we said. We haven't figured out what we're going to do yet. We're still debating it. And if they're still debating it, that means that if you call them at 202, Washington, D.C., 202-225-3121, and ask for Speaker Pelosi or Senator Reid's office, you can make your voice heard, too. You may have some influence on their decision. I say, and I may be wrong, you know, tell me if you think that it should go another way. I'm pleased to listen, but I say just take the exact same piece of legislation, run it through the same vote process and resubmit it to George Bush, and do it again next month and do it again the month after that until finally you had two Republicans crack on this veto. There's more to come. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
And the dream of an egalitarian America, an America where everybody's rights are respected, an America where entire groups of people are not intimidated simply because they're members of that group, because of the color of their skin, because of their sexual orientation, because of the country that they came from, because of their religion. That kind of an America is not the kind of America that conservatives want. And thus, George W. Bush vetoing his third veto in 7 years now, 6 years. His third veto, the first was stem cell legislation, which would have saved lives. So Bush pro-death. His second was vetoing this funding bill for Iraq, which would have begun the withdrawal of our troops, thus saving lives, not only Americans, but Iraqis. Bush pro-death. And the third, vetoing a piece of hate crimes legislation that would extend hate crimes protections to gays and lesbians, to people because of their sexual orientation, rather than, well, not rather than, in addition to race, religion, national origin. This is incredible. This is tragic. Philip in San Diego. Hey, Philip, what's on your mind?
Well, this veto, his third veto, it really upsets me, but it really doesn't surprise me, because really all they have left is the James Dobsons and the Christian Taliban. But it upsets me for personal reasons, because in 2000, I was on a bus here in San Diego, and there were a couple kids on there, and later I found out they didn't like the way that I looked at them. So they waited until I got off the bus, and I was in East County of San Diego, which is a little bit more remote and not well lit. Three of them got off the bus, cornered me, beat me with beer bottles, empty beer bottles, knocked my teeth out, called me faggot and other expletives that aren't appropriate for morning radio, and did all that to me just because they thought I was gay. Turns out I am, but just because they thought so. So now Bush is saying that it's all right for people to come and go ahead and do that to me.
Yeah, just because you're you. Yes, that's essentially, well, he's saying that that would still be a crime, but there would not be the added penalty of being able to be prosecuted under the federal hate crimes legislation.
And the reason why. It's not hate when somebody's calling you faggot or queer and beating you up just for that reason. That's not hating anybody. Yeah, Tom, we gather gay people. We gather around the country every year. It's coming up here in July in San Diego for gay pride marches and gay pride events. Thousands upon thousands of people come out here and gather. I'm waiting to see now if thousands upon thousands of gay folk and lesbian folk in America come out and start protesting and getting out on the streets and saying, no, we're not going to tolerate this anymore.
Yeah,
if we can come out for gay pride events, we can come out for this. And I think it's something we need to do.
Yeah, I agree. Well said, Philip, and thank you for the call and for the point. Here's the big issue with regard to hate crimes laws. The reason why we have hate crimes is because the distinction between a crime and a hate crime has to do with the victim as an individual or the victim as a group. It's just like the difference between an assault and terrorism. The goal of terrorism is not to kill a certain number of people. The goal of those guys who flew the airplanes into the Twin Towers was not to kill 3,000 people. It was to scare the hell out of the rest of us. That's what terrorism is. That's why it's called terrorism. It's designed to induce terror. And what hate crime crimes legislation says is if somebody is committing a crime, and it has to do with specific criminal behavior, by the way, hate crimes legislation cannot be used against somebody simply because of the words they speak. Somebody calls me a name that offends me, if somebody calls somebody a name based on their ethnicity or their religion or whatever, that's not what we're talking about. But when a crime is committed against a person because they're gay, because they're black, because they're Latino, because they're Muslim, because they're from, you know, France, whatever it may be, when a crime is committed against a person because they're part of a group, that is terrorism. Because the goal of that crime is not just to punish that person for being a member of the group. The goal of that crime is to terrify the entire group. And by the way, it typically works. The KKK was a terrorist organization. They figured if they could lynch one black man, then there would be another 50 who would be terrified of them and not speak up or act. And they were right for a while. Hate crimes legislation should properly be called terrorist legislation. And people who engage in what are prosecuted as hate crimes should properly be called terrorists. We need to call this what it is. And when John Boehner, Boehner, I guess is how he says his name, when John Boehner gets up here and says, good Christians would veto this. I mean, he says, you're thinking something bad, therefore we're going to prosecute. No, this has got nothing to do with thinking bad. This has to do with being terrorists. And this piece of anti-terrorism legislation was just vetoed by George W. Bush, believe it or not. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Four minutes past the hour, 1-866-303-2270, Jay in San Diego, California. Hey, Jay.
Hi. Hey, Tom. First, I want to tell you how much I really enjoy your show. It's you have a really nice approach.
Well, thank you. Let our sponsors and KLSD know.
At any rate, that's
the stuff that keeps it going.
I listened to a call-in yesterday at the Ed Schultz show where you got the usual, we either fight him there or we fight him here. And as it turns out, I'm a recently retired scientist from a Navy research lab and now doing consulting work for Homeland Defense. And I'm a solid-state physicist. We're trying to come up with new ways for nuclear detection, you know, radiation detectors. Uh-huh. That being said, I will tell you that the number one fear or the major concern is human intel. The true enemy that so many people can't connect the dots are the real terrorists, Al-Qaeda. Not Iraq. We went into Iraq under false pretenses, and that was never a threat to the U.S. I maintain that is still the case, independent of what that guy said to Ed Schultz. And our number one line of defense is human intel.
I'm sorry, Jay. Finish your sentence.
Okay. But after that, it's police work, right?
Yeah. Well, let me take it even a step further. During the Cold War, there was the occasional American who was passing off information to the Soviets, particularly in the 40s, particularly in the 50s and early 60s. And typically when they were caught, there were a few who were caught and they said they did it for the money. But several of them who were caught said that they did it because they believed that communism was a better form of government. There were a lot of spies in the Soviet Union who were caught. I'm talking thousands, maybe tens of thousands, who were put into the gulags. I mean, you read Solzhenitsyn's writings, who were either spying for the United States or working against the Soviet state because they believed that the American form of government was the best form of government. My point is that if you want to get good at human intel, the only way you're going to get it is from people who believe that you're the guy with the right solution to how the world should work.
Right.
And so if we want to have people in the Middle East, if we want to have people in Iraq, if we want to have people in Afghanistan, if we want to have people in Pakistan, if we want to have people in Iran, if we want to have people in these countries volunteering, coming to the CIA and saying, and the NSA and volunteering and saying, let me be a spy for you. Let me tell you what's going on inside my country. The only reason they're going to do it is because they look at our country and they say, you guys are doing things right. We want to be like you. And our invading Iraq and Bush calling this thing a crusade, and our transforming the economy of that country in a way that totally devastated it, and bringing in all these huge big contractors and saying, okay, we'll give the money to Bechtel, but we won't give it to the man on the street. What that has done is it has caused right across the Middle East, and not just the Middle East, you'll find Muslims in Indonesia who feel this way. I mean, the blowing up the nightclub in Bali. All over the world, it has caused people to say that they are no longer viewing America as that, you know, shining city on a hill, to paraphrase Reagan stealing a line from Jack Kennedy. That, and because of that, we're having a difficult time getting that human intelligence that you're talking about. And without that human intelligence, yeah, there are people who hate us enough to want to set off nuclear devices in our cities. And our behavior is not only A, driving that hatred, but B, making it increasingly difficult for us to get information about what's going on, because we are losing allies at the level of the individual person from country to country all over the world.
Right, and my point is, I think that point needs to be made, and you said it well, that, you know, this is our front line of defense, and this war in Iraq is hurting us desperately.
Yeah, yeah, it absolutely is. Jay, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Richard in Seattle. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. Normally I get on and I rant and rave. Today I have a genuine question.
Okay.
The question is, I'm a fond lover of the WPA. I've enjoyed their state guides. I've enjoyed their electricity from their dam projects. I've walked on their trails.
We should describe for our listeners, Richard, if I may interrupt you, for our listeners who have no idea what the WPA is, because a lot of people were born after it was, you know, myself included, after it was long gone. It was the Works Progress Administration. It was something that Franklin Roosevelt put together in 33 or 34, as I recall, that was basically make work stuff. He said, you know, let's rebuild the forests. In fact, some of it was to stop the Dust Bowl. Let's rebuild the forests. Let's build bridges. Let's hire artists to do our art. The Detroit Art Institute's museum is filled with art from the 30s from the WPA. Some of it's amazing. Let's hire people to write things. John Steinbeck actually wrote one of his pieces with a grant from the WPA.
When you mentioned the art, too, a lot of it's labor art.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, all of it in the Detroit Art Institute is. It's amazing. If you ever get down there, it's just absolutely amazing.
But you said that there's an act that has now made that illegal, or what Franklin intended. I don't remember the name of the act. That they said it was favoritism.
No. What happened was the goal of the WPA was to put money into people's pockets on the assumption, and this was John Maynard Keynes's notion of economics, that you know, what we call Keynesian economics, that if people have money, they will spend money. The spending of that money will create demand for goods and services, and entrepreneurs will step in and to supply the demand for goods and services and create businesses, which will then hire people, which will then pay money to people, who will then have money to buy more stuff, and at that point the government can get out of the business of creating make-work jobs because they've stimulated the economy. And that's exactly how it worked.
Well, that part I understand. The question I have is, you suggested at one point, I can't remember the name of it, but there was somebody who objected to this, saying that it was basically buying votes, and they made the whole thing.
Oh, sure. Well, that's been the Republican position. I mean, that's been Limbaugh's position. That's the entire conservative position ever since the 40s.
Okay, but what I don't understand
in the 30s.
Is this. How can the WPA be something bad because it's employing people who need jobs, and yet Bechtel, Halliburton, the people who threw out the votes, the registered voters in Florida, all these people can be, they're on the government dole, aren't they?
Well,
aren't they making money off the government? Isn't
there's the difference.
Favoritism?
It is, and there's the difference between the conservative and liberal worldview, the at least at the level of economics, and that is that liberals say, and have traditionally said and continue to say, put money into the hands of people. And this, you know, from unions, you know, and driving up the wages, so, you know, and living wage and minimum wage law, put money into the hands of people, and that will drive the economy. It's called demand-driven economics. And the conservatives say, no. It's all about the elite. It's all about the wealthy and the powerful. The quality of our society is defined by the power and quality of our institutions. And so we want to give money to our big institutions, and they will take care of the rest of it. It's a very top-down, paternalistic worldview, and frankly, it doesn't work. And
they're doing a poor job, aren't they?
Well, it's not that they're doing it. They're doing a very good job of doing what they do, which is increasing, which is creating profits for their shareholders. That's the purpose of a corporation. Halliburton's stock has tripled since the Bush administration came into office, and their dividends are through the roof. Dick Cheney's making out like a bandit. He made more money as everything other than Vice President of the United States last year than he made as President of the United States. The guy paid $600,000 in taxes, and his salary is only $200,000 as VP. So, no, Halliburton is doing very well, thank you very much.
Exactly. Though, that I'm still getting electricity from a WPA project, and yet the buildings that Halliburton has built in Iraq are crumbling.
Yeah, and you're very fortunate to be getting that electricity. We're here in Portland dealing with the remnant of
just before our
Enron.
Tank, we sold and took it to the bank.
In Portland, we have.
Workers still got screwed. It was our intention to build the working dude right out of his pension. We're Enron. When Dick Cheney needs power solution.
I love this song.
We are there to discuss, yeah, Enron. We gave Bush lots of big contributions. Now he's working for us.
So that's the bottom line. You're right. More than half of the power in the United States is being provided by old WPA projects and public utilities who are answerable to we the people, and their first goal is to supply electricity. Whereas some communities, like here in Portland, we are stuck with privatized corporations. This one spun off from Enron, PGE, which is not PG&E, but in any case, that's a whole another thing. Jimmy in Vancouver, Canada. Hey, Jimmy, what's on your mind today?
Hey, just had a couple overall comments, man. I grew up in what I guess you could consider the inner city in New York and moved to Virginia when I was a teenager. And just the contrast between the two, like I never experienced racism, and I used to be real proud to be an American. And, you know, as I got old and I started kind of seeing what was unfolding in front of me, as per, like, work experience and certain, you know, situations being harassed by the police all the time, you know, it kind of started to hit me that, you know, things weren't fair, and you know, I'm married now, I got three kids, and I'm in Vancouver. I wound up moving up to Canada after 9/11, and the company that I work for, we actually repoured the Pentagon after the initial airplane.
Oh, interesting. Is the point of your comment, Jimmy, to the veto of the hate crimes legislation that Bush just did? Is that your point?
Well, no, what I was saying, because I've been listening for a while, and I just been wanting to kind of get it off my chest, and just kind of the overall thing that I'm trying to say is, you know, instead of building prisons, you know, because you're sitting there talking about jobs, you know, instead of sitting there building these prisons, which most of the people who are populating them are from the inner city, why not, you know, use a highway, you know, build the highway,
build jobs,
and use these people for work instead of just sitting there leaving them on the side, and then, you know, you get all these immigrants coming in to find work. And you're not, you know, doing anything for your own people.
Yep. Jimmy, well said. If we took the money that we spend on prisons in the United States, and we have more people in prison per capita than any other nation in the world, and more people in absolute numbers, if we took that money that we spend on prisons and instead did a new WPA, we could, in my opinion, wipe out most poverty in the United States.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Before we hit the road, no turning back once you close that door. You know you really wanna, so what do you say? Let's take Park Avenue and get away. Come on, baby, now don't be shy. hop on in and let you and me go for a ride.
Yeah, just hop on into the political process here and let's take this country back. Take it for a ride. Victoria Jones with us, 20 years, one day since she arrived on these shores at the ripe old age of, what, a year and a half?
That's exactly right.
I thought so. Victoria,
well,
welcome.
Thank you very much.
Always so glad to have you with us. What's going on in Washington, D.C. today? First of all, let me ask you a question,
yeah,
if I may. The Washington Post this morning reporting that Pelosi and Reid have already decided to wave the white flag of surrender and give up the timelines, the deadlines, the benchmarks, whatever you want to call them, and resubmit legislation to Bush that he'll sign. On the other hand, I'm seeing on a number of blogs and hearing from people who have talked with the offices of Speaker Pelosi and Senator Reid that, in fact, no decision has been taken. And a number of our listeners have been calling their offices, and that's what they're hearing. What's the official, and the number, by the way, if anybody wants to call Reid or Pelosi, the number is 202-225-3121. What's the official buzz in Washington, D.C.?
Well, the official buzz in Washington, D.C. is that it would have been very surprising if they had decided to give it up completely, but that, on the other hand, they're pretty desperate to get something through because they don't want to be the ones who cut off all help to the troops, so maybe they had done it. So, in other words, people were willing to believe this story in the Washington Post. They were willing to believe it, but now that it seems to be coming out on the blogs, as you mentioned, I've seen the same things, people are equally willing to disbelieve it.
Yeah. Now, I'm of the opinion that the best political solution for them, and frankly, the best for the country, given that it's impossible that here's 2 months' worth of funding, now get out, is going to be passed, which is what I would prefer, frankly, is that they simply take this exact same piece of legislation, submit it to a vote in the House and Senate again, so it's a brand new bill. It presumably will get voted, you know, it'll get through, and presumably they'll pick up a few Republican votes on the way and resubmit it to Bush and, you know, let him veto it again and then just keep doing that over and over again. I mean,
John Edwards' solution.
Yeah, and the guy was in the Senate. He's no dummy. He's a very astute politician. I think it makes perfect sense. What am I missing something here?
Well, I think you may be missing more of a pragmatic approach that some people would see things in Washington. It's just not seen as a very likely way that it's going to go. People want to get this thing passed, and it's not likely to get passed.
But why?
Bush
has enough money to have his little occupation continue until the end of October. And even after that,
he will not admit.
Right. And even after, the end of August, yeah. And even after that, there's plenty of money slopping around in the Pentagon. I mean, they're missing $2 trillion they can't account for. They can't pull out of their back pocket enough money to get the troops out of Iraq. Come on. Hello?
I'm listening. I'm absolutely riveted.
Well, I didn't mean to go off on a rant. The political calculus that these guys are doing seems to me like it's like they're losing the spine we all thought they had, and
they've also got to factor in the spine of the American people, and at some point it's going to start to look to, this is what they have to factor in, is it going to start to look to the American people as though they are cutting off funds to the troops if they see again and again and again that that's what they're doing?
I don't think they will. I mean, Bush went out yesterday and he lied. He lied, bald-faced lies to the American people that this was cutting off the funds to the troops. It's not that the al-Qaeda in Iraq is the al-Qaeda that attacked us on 9/11. It's not. I mean, it was a series of bald-faced lies, and the Democrats need to get out and say, Mr. Bush is telling you things that are not true.
But do they do it, and are they doing it? And one of the difficulties they've had in the last several years is that, no, they have not been particularly effective in countering the president.
They need to hire Keith Olbermann as their spokesman. I mean, he comes out and says it on TV. He's the only guy on TV who's actually coming out and saying it. And it's just, I guess, Jack Cafferty does from time to time, too. Of all people, you know, the old conservative Republican who used to be on the morning show. Yeah, but I think, you know, Jack is just a professional curmudgeon. And a tip of the hat to him for that. But it just boggles my mind. Anyhow, enough of all that stuff. What else is going on in Washington, D.C.?
Well, then the other thing that we've got going on is that the president is expected to veto this hate crimes bill.
I thought he had done it in the last hour or so. I must have been misinformed.
He's already done it. Maybe you're ahead of me. It may have already happened.
I'm not sure. But, yes.
But it's going down.
Yeah, so we can't have stem cells because that might save lives. We can't pull out of Iraq because that may save lives. And we can't protect the lives of people who are members of minority groups because that would be what?
That gives them extra rights that other people don't have.
Oh, nonsense.
That's the argument. They have extra rights.
I know, and I don't think for a minute that you believe that, do you?
I'm just telling you what it says.
Okay. All right. No, because my point is
you decide.
That's right. That's true. You're the reporter. I'm the guy who rants. The hate crimes legislation is anti-terrorism legislation. It's that simple. Because hate crimes are designed not just to intimidate or harm the individual that is the victim of them. They are designed to intimidate and harm an entire class of people. And that's the exact same thing that bin Laden did when he hit us on 9/11, assuming that it was actually him. It was to try to terrify an entire class of people called Americans.
That was a shot.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, I'm not convinced of anything. My mind is still open.
Okay.
But with regard to 9/11, but with regard to hate crime legislation, it's very clear to me that George W. Bush, who says that he hates terrorism, is going to veto a piece of legislation that is designed to stop domestic terrorism.
Then the other story, of course, that we don't have time for is this pregnancy discrimination coming into the U.S. attorney scandal.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I've got that story. I'll share it with our listeners.
That's great.
Thank you, Victoria. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. Great talking with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio. Program on Air America Radio, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
You know, in the largest sense, what we've been talking about all day here, or in the last 2 hours of this program, is the idea of the commons. The idea of starting out with the commons in Iraq and the need for it. And Bush's idea that the only way that you can have security is if you have enough police. And you know, frankly, demonstrably wrong theory.
But success is a level of violence where the people feel comfortable about living their daily lives. And that's what we're trying to achieve.
So he believes from his worldview, he believes that that low level of violence comes about from there being enough police to restrain people from being evil. And my suggestion is that low level of violence comes about from people being employed, from them having jobs. The people who are blowing up our soldiers right now are people who a year ago, 2 years ago, well, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, were butchers and bakers and candlestick makers. I mean, they were the mechanic down the street. It was the school teacher. They're working people. Just as the infrastructure and the industries of Iraq have been privatized and sold off or abandoned and neglected, the same thing is happening in a smaller way, in a much smaller way, but nonetheless slowly and inexorably here in the United States. Andy Gauss is with us, andygause.com, his website. He's the author of The Secret World of Money and Uncle Sam Cooks the Books. Andy Gauss, welcome to the program.
Well, hello, Tom.
Hey, great to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Why are America's ports, airports, and toll roads on the auction block?
Well, I think we have nothing left to sell. We have nothing, no further way to get money into circulation. People have borrowed until their eyes are bleeding. And it is this engine of debt, if you will, that fuels this economy. So without the American people borrowing, we need to increase the supply of money. How do we do that? Well, we monetize our infrastructure. We take our toll roads and our airports and everything else that we haven't already sold off and we sell it off to the highest bidder.
Yeah. Now, you know, in a very real way, this is what Ronald Reagan set out to do with the Reagan Revolution in 1981, when he suggested that government should be shrunk down dramatically, that government had no business running air traffic control systems, that it had no business running public roads, the large public roads in any case, that you know, all of this stuff was big government and it should be privatized.
Indeed.
This is just, you know, and but they knew that the American people would never vote for that, and so what they did was, as Grover Norquist laid out, well, for that matter, as David Stockman laid out, you know, in his tell-all book after the Reagan administration was over, they set out to bankrupt the country so that we'd be forced to do this.
Exactly. Yeah, they wouldn't have the money to spend, so they'd have to close down. Unbeknownst,
right.
I don't know if they had this in mind, that, for example, all of the major deals that have taken place for toll roads so far have involved foreign companies.
Right, primarily French and Spanish companies,
right,
as I recall.
Yeah, French for the water and Spanish for the roads.
Yeah, so our infrastructure is being sold off to foreign corporations. How far down the road are we on this?
Well, it depends where you start counting. I mean, our first real big privatization came in 1913 when we privatized the issue of money. So when we took the Federal Reserve banking system and, you know, subcontracted the issue of money to the big banks of the day, that was really the first big step towards privatization. Then in 1968, we privatized the Federal National Home Mortgage, Fannie Mae.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's just been, though, very recent, starting 2005, and the idea of doing the airports, the toll roads, the bridges.
Well, states have been privatizing toll roads since the 80s. I mean, in Chicago, Chicago or Indiana, I recall driving across there in the 80s on private toll roads.
Yeah.
Or am I misremembering?
Those were the pilot programs in the 80s. But the full-scale rollout, if you will, has only been in the last couple of years. If we look at it in sporadic form, for example, the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel was built with private money. But I'm okay with that. You know what? If a private company puts up the money and builds something that we need and then, you know, charges a toll for it, hey, I'm okay with that. The idea, however, of taking a toll road, for example, that we've already sunken and paid our money for, and then selling that to a private enterprise or a lottery, to me, that just, I think we're heading down the wrong road. Of course, we're running down that road full speed ahead, so I doubt if my little voice is going to stop it.
Well, perhaps never underestimate your little voice, Andy.
Thanks, Tom.
And all of our collective little voices here. We've leased to private investors the Indiana Toll Road, $3.8 billion, Virginia's Pocahontas Parkway, $611 million, the Austin, Texas Toll Road, $1.3 billion, the Chicago Skyway, $1.8 billion. They're talking about Midway Airport in Chicago, the New Jersey Turnpike, the lotteries, the state lotteries in Illinois, Indiana, and Texas. I mean, not just our physical infrastructure, but also our economic infrastructure.
Indeed. You know, I wonder if many of these states, in the case of the lottery, I mean, I can choose not to play the lottery.
Yeah.
But, you know, toll roads, water systems, the kind of critical infrastructure that we really can't get around, no pun intended, that's the stuff that we really, really shouldn't be privatizing. And least of all, if we're going to privatize it, we shouldn't be selling it to foreign companies. You think of all that easy pass and toll road information that will now be in the hands of effectively foreign nationals.
Right.
Lord knows what they'll do with that information.
Yeah, well, here's the problem. We are buying from the world $800 billion a year more stuff than we are selling to the world.
Right.
So the world ends up with $800 billion worth of dollars, and it's actually probably closer to a trillion when, you know, if you filter everything out, plus interest and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
But let's use the $800 billion number. They're sitting on $800 billion, they're accumulating $800 billion a year, and that's in U.S. dollars. Now, U.S. dollars are only, redeemable in the United States, ultimately,
right,
when at the end of the day.
Right.
And so they come back to the United States and they say, well, okay, we'll buy Chrysler from you. We'll buy, we'll buy land and build an auto factory. We'll buy, we'll buy a steel company. We'll buy, this isn't just the issue here is not just the privatization of the public wheel, the public wealth, the commonwealth, as it were. This is also the acquisition of the United States by foreign corporations as a direct consequence of 26 years of insane trade policies that have turned us from a net creditor nation. We were the largest creditor nation in the world the year that Ronald Reagan came into office in 1981.
That's right.
We are now the largest debtor nation in the world.
And our money supply has grown by 12-fold. You know, Monetary Decontrol Act came in 1980. Prior to 1980, the Federal Reserve was limited in what they could create or turn into money. And their limit was it had to be a federal obligation. So if the federal government wrote a bond for $1 billion, and no one wanted to loan them $1 billion, then the Federal Reserve was authorized to create $1 billion and loan it to the government. Well, that Monetary Decontrol Act said that they could now turn any debt instrument into money for anyone. So if a foreign company wants to buy our toll roads, why, then they, the Federal Reserve, could simply create that $3.8 billion that was given to Indiana, or the $2 billion given in Chicago. It is, in fact, the engine of inflation. We went from $1 trillion when Ronald Reagan took office, that was our total money supply, to over $12 trillion today. And you're right. It is all this money coming back to haunt us that's buying up every tangible asset in sight. I recently saw a $10 Indian from 1930. Now, this was a $10 gold piece that was used as money in 1930. Sell at auction to a foreign investor for $1.5 million.
Now, obviously, most of that's numismatic value, but your point is well taken. Yeah, your point is well taken that $10, even $10 in 1913, would buy what today would be probably close to $600 or $700, I would guess.
If you look at it in just the purest gold sense, throw out the numismatic value for a minute. $20 gold piece is about an ounce of gold. And in 1913, you hear Grandpa say, well, I'd work all week for $40.
Right.
Well, today, two $20 gold pieces are worth about $1,200. And that's a living wage for a week for a working guy. Sure, he can feed his family on that. No problem.
Right. In other words, our commodities have stayed the same. Our money is going down. The price of oil, gasoline is not going up. The price of gold is not going up. The value of our money is going down.
You hit it, Tom.
Andrew Goss, Andy Goss, andygause.com, the website. Andy, thanks for being with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, brother.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Stick around.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Secure job. Now that job is going overseas. No, you cannot blame it on the Walmart. It's just one department store. America's competitors are calculating predators. We don't own our country anymore. Search in any shopping mall. Foreign stuff from wall to wall. Witness a phenomenon sad and strange. We need leaders who can see free trade isn't really free. Something has to turn around. Something has to change. Can't you see the writing on the wall?
In fact, David Sirota writing about this today over at davidsirota.com. There's a lot of people starting to talk about this issue, that free trade ain't free, that Thomas Friedman is wrong, and that the destruction of the American economy as a consequence of Reaganomics and Friedmanomics has reached the point where it is undeniable. Paul Craig Roberts, a former editor at the Wall Street Journal and the former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury under Ronald Reagan, writes about this. He just says, let's just take a random month. He's pulling out July of 2005. This is a piece he actually wrote in 2005. But this, for all practical purposes, just a random month. 207,000 jobs are created. Of those new jobs, 26,000, 13%, are tax-supported government jobs. That leaves 181,000 private sector jobs. Of those private sector jobs, 177,000, 98%, are in the service sector. In other words, we're not making anything anymore. Here's how it breaks down. 30,000 food servers and bartenders, 28,000 health care and social assistants, 12,000 real estate brokers, 6,000 credit intermediation. Yeah, it's a whole new industry, helping people get out of the debt that they're in. 8,000 transit and ground passenger transportation, 50,000 retail trade, Walmart's hiring, and 8,000 wholesale trade. The total number of manufacturing jobs are construction jobs, 7,000 of them, which Roberts notes were mostly filled by people who are in the United States without permission to work in this country. He says economists assume that every high productivity, high paying job that is shipped out of the country is a net gain for America. We are getting things cheaper, that they say, perhaps, he says, for a while, until the dollar goes. What the cheaper goods argument overlooks are the reductions in the productivity and pay of Americans employed in manufacturing, technical, and scientific capability. Here's how it goes. The sound recording industries of the United States, 97% foreign-owned. Commodity contracts, dealing, and brokerage industries, 79% foreign-owned. Motion picture and sound recording industry, 75% foreign-owned. Metal ore mining. This is the raw material of America. The stuff we used to pull out of the ground, and in World War II we turned into tanks and airplanes. Metal ore mining, 65% foreign-owned. Wineries and distilleries. I buy California wine. Yes, but did you know that the California winery? 64% of all our wineries and distilleries are foreign-owned. Book publishing. One of my, in fact, on Monday, I'm having breakfast with my editor, one of my editors at Random House, who has published three of my books now. What Would Jefferson Do? The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight and The Prophet's Way, which is now in print from a different publisher, but they had originally published it. And Random House, what was one of the largest publishers in the United States, still is owned by a German company, Bertelsmann, the largest publisher in the world. 63% of all book publishing in the United States, foreign-owned. Well, at least we're still making concrete here, aren't we? Building highways, putting up buildings. And when Halliburton, Bechtel, and these American companies, Halliburton's going to become an OAE and for Emirates, what's it? Dubai, thank you. It's going to become a Dubai company. And, of course, KBR has already reincorporated in the Caymans, as I recall. But you say, well, you know, at least when we make things, we're making it with good old American concrete, right? Digging that dirt out of the ground and mixing it up in our cement mixtures. Well, sorry to lay this on you, but 62% of our concrete industry in the United States is foreign-owned. Well, at least we're still making our own engines, airplane engines, turbines, power transmission equipment, all that stuff, the core infrastructure that keeps this country vital. We got to be making that, right? 57% of that is foreign-owned. We're talking about the stuff that's made in the United States. What that means is that when we make these things, first of all, what it means is that companies with interests and loyalties that are not those of the United States can pull a plug on us anytime and just say, yeah, we're not going to make this stuff in America anymore. We'll move it to Mexico. And then we have nothing. Number one. And number two, what it means is the Reaganites and the Bushies are fond of talking about insourcing. Isn't that marvelous that Toyota's building factories in the United States? They're giving jobs to Americans. Yeah, it is. Except that when you consider, where's the profit going? Because the whole point of having a company, having a business, is to make profit. Where's the profit going? It's going outside the United States. Plastics production. Plastic. Remember Dustin Hoffman? You know, Mrs. Robinson, plastics, young man. 51% of our plastics manufacturing and forming industry in the United States, foreign-owned. Insurance, 51% foreign-owned. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. This Sunday, 3 days hence. Actually, this afternoon I'm flying out to New York. I'll be doing the first hour of our program tomorrow, our Brunch with Bernie segment live from Air America headquarters. And then the second and third hour, my good friend Peter B. Collins is going to be filling in for me on the program here. And then on Saturday, I'll be flying back to Los Angeles. And on Sunday in L.A., May 6th at 2 p.m. at the University of Judaism, I will be on a panel with Bill Handel, Doug McIntyre, and Dennis Prager debating the impact of talk radio. To register for that, you can call 310-440-1246. Then May 11th, KLSD, putting on a gig in San Diego, California. We'll be there at a listener party at the Cosmopolitan Restaurant in Old Town, 4 to 8 p.m. And May 17th, KKZN, AM 760 in Denver, Colorado, putting on a live show at the Boulder Theater, 9 a.m. to noon, am760.net for more information on that. And on May 19th, we'll be in Santa Fe, KTRC, putting this thing on at the Greer Garson Theater for a presentation and a book signing. I'll be doing a whole song and dance there, so a lot of fun coming up, a lot of good times. Diana on the line in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Diana, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Tom, I really love your show.
Thank you. I'm
just a loyal listener here in Olympia. But I'm calling because I picked up the current issue of Vanity Fair, and they have a fascinating article about this water, and big water now is a thing I never even thought about. And I always thought I was such a good environmentalist. And it said that, like, this $38 billion company called Veolia, mm-hmm. It runs in 57 countries with 70,000 employees, and they are privatizing water systems around the world. And here in this country, 100 years ago, over half of our water was private, and thanks to our own people, it's now up to 85% that are public, because we saw that the poor were getting screwed again. And also that nearly 5 out of 7 of the major rivers in China, and I think we have to be very concerned about what's going on in China, because all of this garbage that we're buying from China is so made with so much pollution involved. But 5 out of 7 of the major rivers in China are 80 to 90% very polluted, and the people along those rivers are digging wells, and those cities are telling them to stop digging the wells because the water table's going down. And then this Veolia, it used to be called Vivendi, and we know they got in trouble, so they changed their name to Veolia, but that it was started by the French nobility back in 1853, and it's all about the money.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and this, back in the late 90s when I wrote the Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, that book, without going into a whole long thing, yes, I pointed this out, and a lot of us have been saying for a long time, you know, everybody's talking about oil, we're going to run out of oil. Frankly, I think that the water crisis is going to hit us much harder and much faster than the oil crisis, and already is. And there's a whole bunch of people making a whole pile of money on this, and they have big conferences all around the world about how to privatize water. They are huge lobbyists. And
the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund are some of the baddest bad guys involved in this.
Yep, Yes, and we'll be talking on Monday with David Corton about that, who's an expert on these topics. And, by the way, was that the copy of Vanity Fair with Leonardo DiCaprio on the cover?
Honey, I can't turn away from Leonardo DiCaprio's face. That's what caught me. And then I saw it was the green issue, and I'm in my 50s, but I just love Leonardo.
Yeah, well, he's the reason he's on the cover of that issue is because he has a movie coming out this summer called The 11th Hour.
I know, and
I'm in that movie, and I'm also in that issue of Vanity Fair. So you know, have fun. And if you go to LeonardoDiCaprio.com or .org, you will find a little 10-minute web movie that he made called Global Warning, which is based on my book Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. And he acknowledges that at the end of the book.
Well, you are a treasure to the earth. You are yourself. And
thank you, Diana. Oh, I'm hair trigger there on the button. I'm sorry. Thank you for your kind words. I wasn't fishing for that, and I was bragging, which I probably shouldn't do. So we'll stop that right now. Jeff in Tacoma. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Before I get into I wanted to talk about privatization, but I called Nancy Pelosi's office and Harry Reid's. Harry Reid's mailbox was full, and both times I got through, I got dropped probably because I'm not from his state. Nancy Pelosi's guy took me, but he was trying to get me off so fast I had to squeeze it all in. Basically, my position is he's like a, and if you give him what he wants, it just emboldens him. So what you need to do is step it up, you know, put him in timeout for 4 minutes instead of two. So there's the Woolsey-Waterley bill that is comprehensive. It'll solve the problems in Iraq. It'll mend the fences between the people that live there. And it's probably the best thing. So we should go there instead of going farther back. And my other thing was impeachment. Is the next step. If he vetoes hate crimes legislation, the guy's in. Go.
Yeah. Jeff, your phone is breaking up, and we're only hearing about every fifth word. You wanted to make a quick point about privatization?
Yeah, privatization of the Postal Service is up. And that's one thing that everywhere it's been tried, anywhere in the world, it's been a disaster. Service has gone down. Prices have gone way up.
They're already privatizing the Postal Service. Here in the Portland area, there are several new communities, and Jeff, I'm sorry, your phone is just too bad. There are several communities, Beaverton, for example, one of the bedroom communities of Portland, I guess would be a way, or suburbs of Portland, although it's not a suburb, it's a town in and of itself and always was. It's just, they've kind of grown together. It has been experimenting with privatizing post offices, you know, bringing in private contractors and whatnot, or the post offices doing it. And this is something that just, you know, do you really want a guy who last week was a pizza delivery man and next week will again be a pizza delivery man delivering your Social Security check or your credit card bills? Somehow, I think not. Somehow I think not. David in Granby, Massachusetts. Hey, David.
Hello. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you for calling.
I was listening to what you had to say about the hate crimes legislation, and I have, I guess, what could be a mild concern. It seemed like hate crime legislation requires that the judicial system be able to do what Bush is supposed to be able to do, you know, look into people's eyes and read their souls.
Not true, David. Yeah, that's your right-wing talking point 101. Hate crime legislation says that if somebody commits a crime, an actual crime that could be prosecuted under other terms, a crime of violence, and you can demonstrate in a court of law beyond any reasonable doubt, beyond any shadow of a doubt, that the motivation for that was the attempt not only to intimidate that person, but to intimidate that person as a member of a group, in other words, to commit terrorism, then there's an additional penalty.
Well, I certainly agree with that, but hate crimes were also committed by people in the past who also had the expectation that they would never be prosecuted for it.
Doesn't mean that you don't outlaw that.
Well, no.
People got away with robbing banks back in the 1820s. That doesn't mean you don't outlaw it.
No, I know. But it used to be that in this country, a white mob could lynch a black man. And even though everybody in the community knew who did it, they would never be prosecuted.
And this hate crime legislation is an attempt to make sure that that kind of thing never happens again, or if it does, that the penalties are that much greater.
Well,
when somebody is attempting to intimidate not just an individual or harm just an individual, but in addition to harming that individual, attempting to intimidate an entire group of people, that moves into a different category. That is no longer a crime. That is a terroristic act. And we call domestic terrorism of that sort that's directed toward individual groups, hate crimes, and they should be appropriately penalized. It's not a matter of, I'm going to wonder what this person's thinking. No, no, it's not that at all. I realize that's the right-wing talking point, but that's not it. We're talking about domestic terrorism here. Very, very simple. Is it Kevin in Silver Spring, Maryland?
Yeah, that's me.
Hey, Kevin, what's up?
I just wanted to contribute to your very well-developed discussion about difference between progressive-minded and conservative worldviews. And I have a comment more on an individual level. It's more a matter of the people that I know which are more conservative-minded tend to be much, much more selfish, self-obsessed, and also just generally fearful with regard to how they view the outside world. It's like they're incredibly focused on worrying about someone taking something from them. It's like a never progressing past 12-year-old. And I'm sure most of the conservative listeners to this program will probably, you know, want to rip me to shreds after me saying that, but it's just an observation I made on a purely
You listen to their rhetoric or you read their writings, and that's very much it. It's all about they're claiming that they are victims. They're claiming that they are being oppressed. They're claiming that they are that there's some kind of a conspiracy, you know, liberal conspiracy out there, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, this recent study on Bill O'Reilly that, you know, every 6.5 or 8.6 seconds or whatever it is, he's vilifying somebody. That's the mindset of us versus them and of being very, very fearful, of being very, let's draw a circle in the sand and it's just us in here and all of them out there, they're the bad guys. And it's frankly a tragedy. And I think that some people, because of dysfunctional upbringings or whatnot, are naturally drawn to that. And others, I believe that there are some conservatives out there who are just misguided idealists. You know, particularly the libertarian conservatives. And it's tragic. We need to wake them up. We need to embrace them and say, hey, brother, hey, sister, figure out how the world works here. Come on, let's make a better world together. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Let's not lose democracy here. By the way, consider, you want to take a vacation this summer, consider joining us in Dubrovnik, Croatia. Louise and I are going to this conference, Transforming Culture from Empire to Global Community, put on by the Praxis Peace, it is the Praxis Peace Conference, praxispeace.org, June 3rd through the 9th in Dubrovnik, Croatia. Rianne Eisler, Tom Hayden, George Lakoff, David Corton, Francis Morla Pace, Swami Beyondananda, and others. We'll be hanging out there and having a good old time. And we will be doing our program from, we're going to try and do it every day. We'll see how many and how much of it we can do given the vagaries of ISDN communication between Croatia and New York City. But we will be doing as much of this program as we can live from Croatia as well. So it should be an interesting time. Lewis in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Lewis, what's on your mind today?
You know, it's interesting. I think the reason the Bush administration is reluctant to sign the hate crime legislation is there's probably a U.S. attorney in Arkansas that's begging him not to do it because his activities running the caging list and disenfranchising a huge number of black registered voters might be considered hate crime legislation, though he might be able to slip through the election laws. He might not be able to avoid the hate crime label.
Oh, that's interesting. Some of the where they're sending out letters and flyers in African American communities saying that if any member of your community or any member of your family has ever been arrested even for a traffic ticket, you will go to jail if you show up to vote and stuff like that. Hey, that's an interesting concept. Brody in Edgewood, Texas. Hey, Brody.
Hey, Tom. How you doing today?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind?
I hear you. Going back to the call you had on earlier, or the guy you had on earlier talking about outsourcing everything, I was just saying, why don't we, the people, own our own money? Why do we rely on the Federal Reserve to print our money?
That's a really good question, Brody, and there's not a really good answer to it. This is a debate that literally goes back to the founding of this country. The
right.
biggest debate between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson, when Jefferson was Secretary of State and Hamilton was Secretary of the Treasury in the Adams administration, or maybe back in the Washington administration, I forget which, one of the first two presidencies. It was the George Washington administration, was whether or not there should be a federal bank. The Constitution gives the government the right to mint coins, to create, you know, coinage. But it doesn't specify how that money should be handled once it goes out of the Treasury. And so what Hamilton was saying was that there should be a federal bank, that the government should create banks and should own all banks. And what Jefferson was saying was that the individual states should have their banks, that the banks should be at the level of the state, and the states should actually even be able to issue, to a certain extent, their own currency authorized by the federal government. And both happened. And there were two U.S. banks, and one collapsed in the 1830s, and the second bank collapsed in the 1840s. And some argue that even led to the mini depression that helped bring about the Civil War. And the election of Andrew Jackson back in 1830, whatever it was, the main thing that he ran on was destroying the first U.S. bank and doing away with that, because people got it that these banks were somehow involved in these cycles of boom and bust that were happening. But for a long time, it was just an absolute mess. And in 1813, the Fed was created as a quasi, as a government authorized corporation, and the federal government doesn't authorize many corporations. The word corporation isn't in the Constitution.
Right.
It brought into being this entity, but the Federal Reserve Board, the Federal Reserve is actually owned by 12 member banks. And
right.
Each of those banks is then owned by their member banks. So when I lived in Montpelier, Vermont, for example, my bank was the Chittenden Bank, which was a local Vermont bank. That bank was a member. In other words, it owns stock in the First National Reserve Bank of Boston, which a whole bunch of New England banks own stock in that Fed Bank of Boston. That Bank of Boston is one of the 12 banks that owns 1/12 of the Federal Reserve System. So if I bought stock in the Chittenden Bank, I'm buying stock in the Federal Reserve. It's privately owned. And yet the governor of the Fed is appointed by the President of the United States. So there's this relationship between this private corporation and the federal government. And it's an unending source of dispute among people of goodwill about whether this is the right way to do it or the wrong way to do it, whether the federal government should control all the banking or not, because, the argument goes that the federal government controls all the banking, then they'll just create money out of nowhere. I mean, that's what happened in the Weimar Republic, where you had 1,000% inflation.
Now?
Well, it is to a certain extent, but in theory, there's a certain amount of, regulation in the system, in the process, because these private banks, I mean, this is how the theory goes, don't want to see their value collapse. I frankly, I see both sides of this. I see the good that's done. I also see the harm that's done. And I'm very concerned about the fact that our money supply is in private hands.
Right.
But I honestly don't know a better solution. And,
so where's our money back with, Tom?
It's backed with the full faith and credit of the United States of America. And, Nixon
right.
took us off the gold standard in 72. And that raises a big problem. That's a big one that you put your finger on there. And that is the inflation of our currency, our currency not having anything other than just the credibility of the United States behind it. What happens when the credibility of the United States goes away? What happens if China says, we're not going to buy your debt anymore? What happens if we have 26 years of conservative economic policies where we have presidents borrowing us into debt over and over and over again to the point where the full faith and credit of the United States is meaningless? Then we will have massive inflation. And that's something that a lot of us are very concerned about. Anyhow, it's a huge topic. And we've devoted hours to it in the past, and we will again in the future. Thanks for the call. Tomorrow, Anything Goes Friday. I'll be coming to you from New York City for the first hour for our Brunch with Bernie segment, taking your calls, Senator Bernie Sanders. At the second and third hour of our program tomorrow, Peter B. Collins will be filling in for me, and I'll be back on Monday. Thanks so much for being with us, and don't ever forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.